everything's true. Hello. I have something for you, if you'd like it. It's a technology, a mental device, something that you can use at need, that might help you in your daily life. At the very least, its contemplation might afford you some measure of entertainment. It is, of course, an idea. In fact, it is the idea embodied in the title of this program. A noun,
everything,
an adjective,
true,
and a contracted verb. Everything's true. A perfectly reasonable example of the use of common English vocabulary, which makes no sense, is downright oxymoronic, since logic would dictate that the set of things implied by the word everything must surely include those things that are provably false. But the fact that the phrase cannot be understood may be its most important feature in this usage. For the conceptual heart of this idea lies in a belief that human consciousness, the thinking apparatus of contemporary Homo sapiens, is but one point on a vast spectrum of mind that is, and it is not at the highest point. This is a belief and not a so-called fact of our consensual knowledge set, because at our present level of understanding we can identify no irrefutable evidence indicating the existence of any form of life higher than our own. But a significant percentage of the life forms on this planet are unaware of the existence of humankind. So, accepting the belief, it would apparently take a higher level of evolution than ours to be able to perceive our exact position in the spectrum. It is reasonable to begin from the supposition that we may be somewhere near the middle, which means that mind exists at evolutionary levels as high in relation to us as are we to the lowest minds of which we are aware. Wherever we may lie on that graph, the simple fact that there might be higher is enough to inform our understanding of reality. Since there are vast areas of the experiential world that we as humans can perceive that are inaccessible to lower life forms, it is fair to extrapolate that higher forms than ourselves may be able to perceive vast areas inaccessible to us, perhaps on a scale equivalent to the difference in awareness between a man and an ant. We cannot know what elements of our collective experience might actually be evidence of aspects of reality beyond our capacity to perceive or comprehend. If we were able to record the dreams of an ant, it is likely there would be nothing there we couldn't explain or demonstrate or fit into the script of a 3D animated feature film. So there is nothing within even the full extent of human imagination that within the larger context of that which is beyond our capacity to conceptualize is not somehow existent, real, true. That's everything. The fact that we can't understand it is its greatest proof. Humor is a fascinating thing. It is possible that the first time you heard the title of this program, you laughed. I have a theory about laughter. I believe that when the mammalian brain started to become particularly complex, it also began to experience logic loops. You know what I'm talking about. It's that thing that happens to computers in old sci-fi shows when presented with irreconcilable data. You say to them,
"Computer,
everything I say is a lie," followed by, "I am lying." For some reason in these shows, the computer always blows up, but in the evolving mammal, the effect could have been just as deadly. They froze. Became frozen food, if you will. I believe adaptive evolution provided a solution, a reflex designed to expel the offending information. Modeled on other reflexes designed to expel foreign material from the body, it was accompanied by percussive exhalation and vocalization. To reflect its positive effect on potential survival of the genetic material, it was afforded a pleasure response, such as is allocated most extravagantly in the case of reproduction. When something inexplicable occurred, you laughed it off and continued fleeing. At some point, some enterprising individual discovered that by creating the incongruity, by mimicking another animal, say, they could trigger the effect in others with its attendant pleasure response. In a social animal, this could become a valuable trait for generating bonds and increasing reproductive opportunity. Long before language, I believe, the ladies liked a good sense of humor. This is just another idea, but again I had to use the word belief, because the scientific consensus, the agreed-upon knowledge set of our species, does not support this idea, if anybody before has even proposed it. It would take a far more brilliant mind than mine to conceive of a way that such an idea might be proved, according to contemporary criteria. Perhaps a time machine. But how about you? Do you believe it? Carl Jung once said,
"The word belief is a difficult thing for me. I don't believe. I must have a reason for a certain hypothesis. Either I know a thing, and then I know it. I don't need to believe it."
What is it to believe? You believe you are where you are, who you are. After that, things might get a little gray. We would not have to go back in time very far, in evolutionary terms, to discover people vigorously defending the commonly held position that there is no such mythical land as China, or that the Earth is at the center of our system. If they were wrong, how wrong are we? And what about that time travel idea? Do you believe in it? I've always had a problem with time travel because for some reason it never mentions space. If I went back in time 100 years right now, the odds are I would be floating in space. Not only is a planet in constant motion around the sun, but 100 years ago the planet on which I am so conveniently located was very far from here. We've moved a little piece around the galactic core, and the whole galaxy is moving in relation to the other large identified bodies. So not only do I want to go back in time, however that's happening, but I also want to perfectly track the path of the Earth back to that exact moment with so much precision that I will appear on the surface at exactly the right height in exactly the right space, moving at exactly the right relative velocity so as to match the movement of this earlier Earth, to get it wrong by even the most minuscule of degrees to risk limitless potential annihilation. There are many writers out there who have addressed this question, but the fact that so little popular time travel fiction makes any mention of the problem is evidence to me that the Copernican Revolution, the belief that the Earth is not the center of the universe, never really took. So, how do you experience the world? Are you hurtling through space on a vast ball that is yet dwarfed by the vaster fireball that is a vast distance away and comes into view as the planet rotates, and which is itself dwarfed by many of the other objects we can see when we're facing away from it that are even vaster distances away? Or do you stand on a solid level world, and the small but intense sun rises and sets, and the tiny bright stars wheel about you?
Wait a minute, isn't this all about everything being true? How come both those perspectives be true?
Well, let's see. Since we have identified no point of origin in the universe, no stable reference marker from which to measure all stellar motion, it seems valid for an individual to decide that this stable point rests at the center of our planet, about which the rest of our observable universe is apparently rotating.
No way.
Or, from an experiential perspective, every individual has his own unique truth, their one-of-a-kind internalized universe.
Oh, come on.
That's a cop-out.
Or, it is possible for an individual to hold more than one apparently contradictory idea in their mind simultaneously, switching between them as appropriate, like an astronaut in zero-G assigning the attribute of down to whichever direction suits the needs of the moment. But this is just describing something in a way that makes it fit into your brain. Sort of.
Yeah.
Which is always a fun exercise, but at the heart of everything's true is the belief that by necessity, the absolute truth of, let's call it, reality, can not fit into your brain, because you, like me, are only equipped with a human brain, with the installed software of the program we call civilization, at this particular moment in that program's ongoing development. Not only could this brain appear primitive to future generations in its own evolutionary line, but may very well be spectacularly primitive compared to those, let's call them brains, that have elsewhere evolved. As primitive as we may be, we do have a few tools to work with. We have, for example, imagination. So imagine that you are the size of an ant. Three ants are together, looking at the hill atop their colony, which has apparently been crushed. From our perspective, we can see a huge depression in the shape of the print of a boot in the soft sand. Just one corner of a heel has flattened their hill. The eldest ant speaks.
"We know not whence comes the boot, but the boot comes. Then we must rebuild."
The second ant is younger, more thoughtful.
"No, you are wrong. I felt the trembling of its presence, the wind of its passage. The boot loves us. It wants us to be better. It crushes our hill that we may build a better one to its glory."
The third ant is a grizzled worker, one of the thousands that have streamed out of the deep colony at the alarm of the destruction, and he laughs.
"Ha! There is no boot. The boot is a myth for the idle chatter of the young. This is just something that happens, like the seasonal floods or that aphid swarm. Some day we may understand the mechanisms at work, but until then, let's get to work."
Just then another ant, one of the far-ranging foragers, comes rushing up, quivering with excitement.
"Hey, I gotta tell somebody. I was here when the boot came down. I was right over there. I saw it clearly, and I've had a vision. The boot is the end of one of the legs of a giant ant, 1,000 times bigger than an ant. And this giant ant lives in a giant hollow hill, 1,000 times bigger than an ant hill, with just 2 other giant ants, and they only have 4 legs and no antennae, and they walk on just 2 legs, and the giant ant with the boot stepped on our hill without even knowing, because he was on his way to get into his giant moving hill, which travels faster than a rushing river, and which will take him to a giant, giant nest of ant hills 1,000,000 times bigger than the biggest ant hill full of millions of giant ants. And this is just one of tens of thousands of such nests, and they are scattered all over a huge ball bigger than 100 billion of our hills. And in all of everything there are billions upon billions of such balls, and most vastly bigger than this one, and many burning 1,000,000 times hotter than the hottest burning day an ant ever experienced. And these big ants, they drape themselves in woven plants, and they communicate over distances 1,000,000 times farther than any ant has ever traveled, and they have boxes where they watch each other doing things that never happened, and they make tiny symbols that can make another ant hear a voice in its mind."
As this ant had clearly gone insane, they killed it and fed it to the queen.
"Hey, what's up, guys?"
This story is absurd, of course, since while I have called them ants, they have spoken like Anglo-Saxon humans of an earlier century, which is why they are even capable of conceptualizing and exchanging such human ideas. The actual awareness of an ant is apparently unknowable to us, perhaps as unknowable as the mind of that being that is as different in scale to us as are we to an ant. And the point of the story is not, if there is a god, then he is indifferent to us. If the human living near this nest had been an ant researcher, he might have stepped over their hill and maybe come back later to check on their food supplies. Or if it had been a 6-year-old boy, he might have brought a magnifying glass to fry them one by one. The point is that higher does not mean simpler. It means incomprehensibly more complex. Here's another tool of mind, the metaphor. After all, what is being attempted here is not actually possible. We are trying to imagine something that exists beyond our capacity to imagine. So let's use analogy. It does not take much observation to note that technology is moving rapidly. When Arthur C. Clarke coined his famous phrase that
"sufficiently advanced technologies are indistinguishable from magic,"
he was visualizing encounters with primitive tribes or advanced interstellar beings, but the concept is now applicable to generations that may be sharing the same domicile, where the father is baffled by his son's facility with computer programming, and the grandmother is sure that it's the work of Satan. Take the case of the cargo cults, such as the Aboriginal natives of Melanesia, who were suddenly hurled into the 20th century by the arrival in 1943 of plane loads of USGIs with their record players and tinfoil and cigarette lighters. When the troops moved out, the islanders worshipped them like gods, made wooden replicas of their airplanes, and prayed for their return. Now invoking that terribly problematic time travel again, go back a century with only a rudimentary knowledge of the evolution of energy systems and become a vastly wealthy speculator. Go back a millennium with a flashlight and be burned as a witch. Now imagine that you are the simpler human of that remote island or earlier age, and your descendants will develop the ability to travel in time and space, and they are here now observing you. Might they not appear to be magical? As far as we know, the being on this planet that is the most like us and yet is not us is the bonobo chimp. Everyone agrees that chimpanzees are amazing. They demonstrate obvious evidence of the capacity for language, tool-building, problem-solving, abstract thinking, social organization. They can be taught to successfully mimic a huge range of human behavior. Yet for all their ability, there are clearly vast areas of the human condition to which the chimp simply has no access. In fact, there have been chimpanzees, mostly in the performing arts or at Neverland, who have spent enough time in human association that if humans disappeared overnight, would probably get by quite comfortably for some time on their knowledge of packaged foods and human storage. They might even found a new simian form occupying the ruins of human civilization, incorporating learned human behaviors and passing them on to later generations. But they would totally miss the irony when one of them put on an I'm the man t-shirt. Now imagine that you are the chimpanzee in a world where humans long ago made themselves scarce. Let's go down a step in the biological ladder and consider the family dog. This is a complex being with its own astonishing skill sets. Humans regularly anthropomorphize their domestic pets, and in many ways they are not wrong. The dog is an integrated and functional part of human society, may understand us better than any other animal, is capable of learning a vast range of human-assisting skills, and has astonishing tools at its disposal, most especially its nose, which outstrips not only the human organ but also our present level of technological development. You can ask any canine police unit in the world. There is no machine that can react as quickly, dexterously, and intelligently as a dog. Yet one will never rise to the level of detective, or write a hit series about a crime-fighting dog, or even grasp the implications of the cascade of screen images it sees as its master searches through the channels looking for a hit TV series about a crime-fighting dog. Now imagine that you are your dog, and contemplate all the things that surround it every day of its life, but which it clearly does not have the tools to understand, or in some cases even perceive. And the dog, like the chimp, is actually a very close cousin in evolutionary terms. What if we make the step to a far more distant relative? Let us consider again the ant. The ant is astonishingly successful. There may be a million times the number of ants on Earth than humans, despite many people's best efforts to eliminate them. Again, they show astonishing capacities, operating in complex social organizations of many members, building large, intricate dwelling places, exploring huge areas in search of resources. An individual ant is mechanically powerful, resilient, and fast. It can accurately distinguish between thousands of different molecular constructs, navigate great distances, and communicate with fellow members a huge range of information. Yet what is there in an ant that passes for thought as we know it? Do they have chemical reactions that are the ant analogs of fear, love, or hope? Is each one of their awarenesses as rich and textured as your own? Now imagine that you are the ant, in a world heavily populated by life forms, many of which are vastly more evolved than you, and yet that you, because of the limitations of your form, are unable to perceive. We could go further, citing controversial research that might indicate that plants have a measurable degree of so-called sentience. And what could it hurt to imagine that you are a tree, living a full, rich life, exchanging waves of subtle information to those others of your kind, intimately communicating with the living water of the earth, alive and aware in a myriad of ways, and yet for whom the dramas and changes of decades of human history moving beneath your branches are little more than the whisper of a dream. But for analogy, we need not remain within the realm of what we understand as living things. Our technology gives us a wonderful metaphoric tool for the very mind of man itself in the computer. For the present operation of global computer-based systems, a tremendous amount of commonality must exist. But the technology is so dynamic that even the youngest computer users amongst us may be aware of the evolutionary process at work. You may have a very top-of-the-line 486 computer sitting in your office, and it may be fine for running that spreadsheet. But try to run a recent issue game disc on that system, and you'll probably get nothing at all. Literally, the higher form is sufficiently more complex that the lower form's sensory equipment is overwhelmed with strangeness. And this represents the evolution of just one version of one technological form created by one small subset of one species on one planet over a period of only a couple of decades. How much variation is possible?
Possible.
And only the most cynical amongst us cannot see that science fiction is correct in that what we are creating with technology is new forms of life. Add to that the ancient arts of agricultural and animal husbandry leading to a barely imaginable future of genetic manipulation, and it appears that our first impulse upon being given tools of mind is to create more forms of life. What if that is a common trait of life, and everywhere in the universe each ball of matter creates one kind of life, which creates mind, which creates other kinds of life? Given the postulated billions of years of the existence of our so-called known universe, and its indescribable scale, and with the example of our own planet as a guesstimate of relative rates of evolution, how many times might it have happened that a planet produced life, that itself began producing life? How many kinds of life might there be? Which brings us to aliens. Or at least what most people think of when you mention aliens and you're not talking about immigration. It is most likely that when the idea became clear to you that what was under consideration was beings of higher evolutionary scale than humans, your mind went to either angels or some conception of extraterrestrial hominids borrowed from a thousand cultural representations. In the popular fiction where the alien is most commonly presented, there is very rarely anything truly alien. If there were, the audience would not understand it, or perhaps even not be aware of it, and that would not be good for business. Generally, the fictional advanced extraterrestrial life form is an exaggerated or distorted human, or an exaggerated version of the very real monsters faced on Earth in the form of predator, insect, or virus. Humans have experienced tremendous misunderstandings encountering members of their own species from significantly different cultures. How much misunderstanding would there be with a creature that had evolved on a totally different planet? Given the evidence of our metaphoric use of animals and computers, it seems likely that a creature that had evolved in a different star system and was advanced enough to conquer our known laws of time and space to visit this planet would not fall within the bounds of our capacity to perceive. The reason you don't see them here is because you can't see them. And for all you know, they're here. Which brings us to the so-called UFO phenomena. Many a high-profile court case has been decided on vastly less evidence than has been put forth in support of all levels of so-called close encounter. Traditional science has rejected the evidence because it does not conform to present human standards, which is exactly what one would expect from something of truly non-human origin. There can be absolutely no doubt that very many humans have had and are having these experiences. But to presume that what is happening is proof of contact with interstellar travelers, well, that smacks of a limited perspective. In fact, with the exception of those contactees who claim to have been given specific information, there is nothing obviously extraterrestrial about what is happening. All of the sightings have been on Earth or in its close proximity. Many craft are seen rising out of and descending into oceans and lakes and mountains. When beings are seen, they tend to all be a variation on the hominid form, and communicate at least in some measure in human language. By applying everything's true, we make an attempt to recognize the actual scale of potential represented by these fragmentary and elusive data events. Are they Visitors from a parallel universe, a parallel time stream, deep inside the Earth, the Moon, our own future, one possible future, an imagined past made manifest by future ritual. Perhaps they are the accidental leakage from another dimension that shares our world, that is being manifested by our own unconscious. Perhaps they are the side effect of an experimental program that has been automatically operating from a location deep under the Andes since placed there sometime during the Cretaceous period. Perhaps they are evidence of a secret government program. Perhaps they are the dreams of an ant. The most important thing, in a subject where the information is so incoherent and often contradictory, is to resist the urge to reduce it all to a single idea. Since on the scale I am inferring, and given our limited human perspective, it is possible to conjecture that every single close encounter that has ever happened to a human being has had a completely unique source. A meeting with a different alien species, or transdimensional being, or earth spirit, or experimental military craft, or manifestation of the unconscious, or tulpa, or ant dream. It would obviously be impossible to detect a pattern within such phenomena, outside of the fact that they seem to be happening. In fact, any student of the subject knows that there are patterns. And I will add my personal belief, informed by the ET philosophy, that it's all true. But that the researchers are wrong in thinking that their interpretation is correct. It might be wisest to start from the presumption that whatever is being communicated, it is in a language that we do not know, and must first learn before attempting any translation. It could be like a very, very bright light, not meant to be looked at directly because it will overwhelm your vision, but only used to distinctively illuminate our world. There is almost certainly officially classified information related to this subject, probably quite a bit of it, and you may very well live to see a public disclosure of some of these files. But at the present, the general population's relationship to this potentially reality-changing subject is relegated to the area of belief. There is no conflict on this planet that is not, at least on the face of it, belief-based. One group believes their prophet of God is superior, their race or tribe is superior, their morality as expressed through their system of governance is superior. The true cause is usually the well-founded belief of a small number of individuals that other people's beliefs can be exploited to generate conditions under which they can increase their power and wealth. But that cannot be what the general population believes, because if they are being asked to sacrifice their lives for something, it had better have some profound personal significance. It had better be the equivalent of, say, one of the oldest impulses, rooted at the heart of every cell, a lesson learned hard and early on the treacherous road of terrestrial evolution. The willingness for the individual to defend to the death the survival of their genetic material, an impulse that far predates such lofty notions as morality, or courage, or walking upright. If you can tell people what to believe, and then make them defend those beliefs with the same reflexive depth of certainty that they would their own children, then you can give them weapons, and they'll write human history. The specific motivating beliefs usually become irrelevant in the face of the violence that ensues. The beliefs that pave the way for the war machines are deep, but they can change. What about all those things you believe so much that you don't believe that they are beliefs, but incontrovertible facts? Because the simple equation here is, my universe is making noises that is making ideas occur in your universe. And I can't be completely certain that your universe even exists, just as you can't be sure about mine. It seems a reasonable guess to me that posterity will identify as the most important cultural artifact of this era, the film The Matrix. A dystopian vision of an apparently inevitable technology, totally immersive virtual reality. It allows the viewer to contemplate, if only for a moment, the possibility that everything they themselves are experiencing is just an elaborate construct, synthetically generated in the brain. This is the kind of reality-shifting experience usually limited to transcendental meditation, hypnagogic or hypnopompic sleep, severe mental imbalance, or otherwise chemically altered states of consciousness. It's the kind of paradigm-altering perspective change that can make reading too many Philip K. Dick novels dangerous for your mental health. A familiarity with this sensation may turn out to be the most valuable mental asset a human may possess as we race towards an unimaginable future. Consider a couple of other films that deal with mind-state technologies. The 1983 Douglas Trumbull film Brainstorm, in which researchers played by Christopher Walken, Natalie Wood, and Louise Fletcher develop a technology that beams virtual, full-sensory experience directly into the user's brain. And the 1995 Catherine Bigelow film, written by James Cameron, Strange Days, starring Ralph Fiennes and Angela Bassett, in which a similar technology is shown after it has matured and migrated to the street.
Yeah, boot it.
While significantly different in tone, both films address the potential negative impacts of such technology and directly reference military involvement in its development. They raise fascinating questions about what exactly constitutes self, positing such a universality of human thought structures that they can be recorded from one brain and played back in another. For the simplest sensory data, this seems reasonable, but is it not likely that for the subtler elements of experience, emotions, memories, intentions, and the like, each brain has utterly unique allocations, and the firing synaptic array that means Mozart to one is mozzarella to another? What if the process is so complete that when you take off your playback helmet, you remember nothing, because the brain that had experienced the recording was not yours? However these writers have angled their technologies and their interpretations of its impact, the underlying message is consistent through these and other works. There is a strong incentive to develop technology that will directly control human thought. And you don't have to look to science fiction. Declassified World War II and later era documents from many countries show an intense interest and measurable success rate in mind control research, exploring a wide range of approaches. Given the logical assumption that the experimental techniques undertaken that were the most successful are the ones that remained classified, and given the extraordinary leaps that have been made in other technologies during the same time frame, is it not possible that at this very moment you yourself are under some measure of targeted mind control? Perhaps it is a signal subcarried by this program, with trigger words built into my speech. Mind control. Can you be completely certain that some decision you will make in the future, whether to buy that brand of soap powder or vote for that zoning ordinance or invest in T-bills, was not carefully planted there by a sophisticated technology? Hold on a moment. Something just happened. Somewhere in that last paragraph, somewhere around the phrase mind control, something was triggered. Did you feel it? Somewhere in there, you came to understand that what was being inferred was some kind of conspiracy. And everybody knows that's just crazy talk. Let's break this down. Many people are isolated, living in their heads, having been socialized to believe that their primary response to the world should be one of fear. Fear of death, failure, poverty, weakness, abandonment. Even if they achieve a measure of their goals of security, they remain afraid, and they hunger for constant reassurance through continuous achievement or acquisition. They want stuff. Most people are operating in large groupings, most of their focus in a single organization or occupational subset. In order to allow the coherent functioning of these organized subsets of numerous individuals, there must be elaborate rules pertaining to conduct, ethical, moral, legal. Often it might occur that the thing that an individual wants cannot be obtained within these codes of conduct, and so they will undertake a clandestine approach with illegitimate methods. Often it might occur that for the effective execution of this operation, another participant from within the organization is recruited, presumably with the same promise of reward and an understanding that the plan cannot succeed unless it remain unknown to everyone but themselves. This is a conspiracy. Any time that more than one person within a group engages in undisclosed behavior with group resources that services their agenda and not that of the group, you have a conspiracy. This falls neatly into what most people would call human nature, because it is so reliable a potential factor that it can be predicted, and is one reason for a significant number of the elaborate rules mentioned earlier. Without restriction, some people will take what they can get away with, do what they can get away with. It occurs at every level of human organization, in families, at work, at school, in teams. The larger the organization, the more likely its occurrence, such that at the highest levels, that of, say, a multinational corporation or a government, conspiracy is not a possibility, it is a default certainty. If what is at stake isn't just a new car or that corner office, but the fate of nations, the lives of millions and trillions of dollars, to what lengths would you not go? I can readily imagine an individual walking out from a recent release international spy thriller with its teams of super-secret operatives with vast resources, battling teams of super-secret criminals with vast resources, with the stakes so high that almost every law of human society is broken for the greater good, and the general population whose world is being saved often never know anything about the events that have transpired. And that individual will complain because during his 96 minutes of entertainment, there wasn't a sufficiency of plot twists, hidden agendas, secrets that evaded even the highly trained individuals standing right next to them. And yet when that same individual is presented with the idea of a conspiracy in the real world, they will scoff, say how those things only work in the movies, it's too big, someone would talk, people are stupid. All the usual arguments, against the clear evidence of history, that things can't be kept secret. It was centuries before history recorded that Nero was likely behind the burning of Rome. If the Nazis had won the Second World War, it would still not be part of the public record that they had set fire to the Reichstag and blamed it on the communists to acquire greater political control. The single largest wartime enterprise in history, the Manhattan Project, conservatively involved 250,000 Americans. Yet there was not a single media leak and no evidence that the spy cells from Axis nations ever found out anything specific about it until it set fire to the sky over Hiroshima. Even the Gulf of Tonkin incident, a completely manufactured attack in the South China Sea that prompted a large increase in military expenditure for the Vietnam War, might never have been exposed but for the efforts of a small number of relentless investigators. At this moment, millions of people believe the official American accounts of the events of 9/11, despite a staggering number of anomalies and outright impossibilities. And that one was right in your face, from multiple angles. How many things are there that you don't know? More importantly, how many of the things that you believe have you been programmed to believe? Try this experiment when you find yourself in a group of acquaintances. Start to tell a story that does not at first reveal that what you are talking about falls into one of the categories associated with the idea of conspiracy thinking. It's best if you put the trigger phrase, something like mind control, for example, somewhere in the second or third sentence to ensure their mind is actively processing what you are saying in real time. You may find, as have I, that a certain number of your listeners, upon hearing that trigger phrase, will respond remarkably quickly with a negative comment, faster than could have allowed for any kind of reflection. Fast enough to remind me of conditioning. If you were in a position of great wealth and power, and the technique by which you had achieved this status was through hidden manipulation, and you developed technologies that could plant ideas in the mind, then the only idea you have to plant is that such a thing is not possible. Conspiracy is not possible. That's crazy talk. And while we're on the subject, what is the nuttiest image associated with the idea of crazy conspiracy thinking? After a little thought, you might come up with the tinfoil hat. Isn't that the silliest thing? But the fact is that the most promising area of mind control, both for large populations and targeted individuals, quite likely involves some kind of microwave transmission, against which the easiest and most effective defense would be some kind of shield around the head. Interestingly, tinfoil would be one of the worst materials for such a shield, as it would conduct and even potentially amplify microwaves. So those who choose to believe the myth, instead of making themselves shielded, have made themselves antennae. You're having some real trouble with this right now, which of course makes perfect sense if you've been subjected to a lifetime of programming designed to make you dismiss conspiracy thinking. It's too big. Someone would talk. People are stupid. This last one is fascinating because what is being said is not that there are stupid people, but that our leaders are stupid. Those in charge are stupid. As illogical as this appears, after all, would not the least stupid be the most likely to negotiate a path to leadership? It is remarkably widely held as a belief, and, as most extravagantly demonstrated in a recent American president, seems to be often supported in practice. How can such a thing be possible? Is it not more sensible to presume that those at the highest level of earthly power are, in fact, much, much smarter than you? The answer to the riddle lies on the back of the U.S. dollar bill, because the pyramid is the model. Hierarchy is the first commandment, and is promoted in almost every area of human endeavor. From business organizational charts to governmental structures to industry rankings to every single area of media and entertainment, most luridly in mass-marketed sports. The repeated image of the pyramidal structure in which the one at the top gets it all, calls the shots, wears the crown, is perfectly suited to socialize a large population into accepting hierarchical rule, accepting that they are part of a pyramid. Because with a pyramid, the top is very small, and to control the entire structure, you only have to control the next slightly larger number below you, and everyone below that group need know nothing about you at all. It's why the Masonic illustration on the most reproduced image in human history has the capstone floating above the pyramid. The official explanation is that this is the eye of God, but it is more likely the eye of the Big Brother that you can't know about, the rays depicted indicating both great power and invisibility.
Oh, come on, Big Brother!
Brother.
If what you're saying is true, then how come they let you say it, eh?
Yeah!
The obvious answer would be that it is not true. This is entertainment, and hopefully you are amused. Another possibility is that because of its unusual content and lack of credentials, this program will predictably be, on the whole, dismissed as entertainment. And therefore, even though it contains truth, it will build an association in the minds of listeners between the true ideas and the artifice and fiction of the world of entertainment. In other words, it functions as disinformation. Whatever the state of exotic mind control technology may be, disinformation is an ancient and effective technique for controlling human ideas. If you suspect that certain crucial information might get out, you prepare by seeding the public with manipulated versions. For disinformation to work, it has to include the truth, so that truth can be distorted by other information and thereby nullified.
It would be prudent to shield your head from microwaves. People who do that use tinfoil and look like idiots.
Consider again The Matrix. If this is a movie that reveals some hidden truth about the nature of our world, then how could it have been so heavily promoted and distributed? First, of course, because it is a fantasy film that makes no claims to realism, and the ideas in it will therefore be filed alongside Harry Potter's magic and a talking sponge wearing pants. Ostensibly, the protagonist is on a quest to liberate humans from their enslavement to a vast machine. But in their world, reality is a dark nightmare of discomfort and oily danger, while in The Matrix, everyone looks cool and things are beautiful. What if the truth is that wage slaves burning up their lives to fill the coffers of a few is the nightmare illusion in which we've been trapped, while reality is an idyllic world of beauty and love of which we've been robbed?
Hey, what exactly does all this conspiracy talk have to do with everything's true?
Right.
Well, if you're going to attempt to expand the limits of your understanding, the first thing you must do is challenge those things you believe. And the first of those is those things you've been told to believe.
Oh, come on. So I suppose since everything's true, it includes the fact that nothing is true? Oh, my head hurts.
Yeah, what gives?
I think you're just trying to scare people.
Forgive me. But now it's time to ask yourself a question. Why is it you would listen to a program like this, or read print media, or watch a news channel? I'm guessing you, like most of us, hunger for the truth. And you believe that you can only find that truth outside of yourself. Without your parents, your teachers, your society, your media, you wouldn't know what to think. What if the opposite is in fact the case, that there is a direct conduit to the absolute truth of everything, available to every human being, and it is within you, while everything that is outside of you is subject to manipulation and falsification? I call it the enteric nervous system, which is a name given to one of the masses of neurons in the abdomen, but we might as well refer to any of the elements of the peripheral nervous system concentrated in the center of the body. This area of hundreds of millions of neurons is sometimes referred to as the second brain. But it makes more sense to me that this knot of cells is in fact the descendant of the very first brain, in fact the very first nucleus of the very first cell of life, and therefore is directly connected to levels of reality that the evolutionary march of the main brain to the top of the spinal tower has removed from our direct experience. I come from an audio orientation, and I usually experience messages from my first brain as bells and buzzers. If it's true, or if it's false. You may experience it in different ways, and you have experienced it. Many will comfortably accept that what I'm talking about is intuition, but the association that comes with that word will be one of scarcity, a special and, except in the case of extremely rare individuals, unusual occurrence only prompted by extraordinary circumstance. I believe a considerable amount of disinformation has been disseminated with the sole purpose of convincing you that these signals from your body to your brain are occasional and unreliable, when they are, in fact, constant and faultless. And really, who could blame someone for turning it off? They wake up in the morning under polyester sheets in their over-insulated house with a ventilation system full of dust mites and fiberglass, have a big glass of water full of chlorine and fluoride, put on their constricting clothing, go downstairs to eat a bowl of sugar and lactose, drink a big cup of caffeine, get into their gas-burning vehicle, drive down a tunnel of carbon monoxide to their office tower, where they work under fluorescent lights on synthetic carpets, breathing dust mites and aluminum particles, staring at a glowing screen, doing something with no meaning to them, and only take a break to go downstairs and eat the flesh of an animal that has died in fear and pain, full of antibiotics and growth hormones. I promised you a tool by the end of this program, a mental device. If I could awaken in you an understanding and connection to this inner lie detector, then it would be a gift of immeasurable value. But the reality is that in most adults, this connection has been effectively obscured and overlaid with a system of programmed automatic responses. However, this may not be true of your children. If you have a child, ideally just old enough that they can understand simple concepts and relationships, then you might want to give them the gift of their inner lie detector. Wait until the child is alone and absorbed in a simple activity, like coloring or looking at a book. Sit with them, get their attention, and tell them something that is extraordinary but true. Something that you can prove immediately, that you have prepared beforehand. It should be something without any particular emotional weight. It might be something like, "There's a shoe in the fridge." If they're like most children, they will run to verify this unlikely occurrence, and when they return, tell them that the feeling they had the moment they heard that information was their inner lie detector telling them that they were hearing the truth. The next day, repeat the process with a different extraordinary claim, but this time one that is not true. When they discover this fact, tell them to remember the feeling they had when they first heard the information, and that feeling is alerting them to a lie. Over time, repeat this process, randomly determining whether the test will be true or false, until you are sure they get the idea. Then have them tell you what they feel before verifying the information. Make it a game. Make it fun. Do it every day. Do not offer other rewards for being correct. The gift of this ability is greater than any reward you could offer. Teach your child to trust their inner voice, and then let them teach you what is true. Sherlock Holmes is the patron saint of everything's true, which sounds counterintuitive since he was a highly effective expert at reducing myriad apparently chaotic factors into a single revealed truth. But the heart of his technique was in the initial encounter with the evidence. What allowed him to see the extraordinary truth within the mundane chaos was a refusal to rule out any possibility, however improbable. Another tenet of the Holmes philosophy is that the surface truth is usually wrong. You probably specialize in something. You have honed your mind to focus in on one particular area of human activity, and this has brought you a deep understanding of its nature. One thing you may have discovered is that the general population's understanding of your area of specialty is consistently distorted, flawed, or even completely incorrect. This is true for everyone. This is true for you in relation to all those areas in which you do not specialize. I call it everything's true, not because everything is true, otherwise why would you need a lie detector, but because encoded in that phrase is a laugh. And encoded in that laugh is the mystery of the universe. E.T. is an orientation, a choice to confront the world not with layers upon layers of blinders and filters imposed by society or adopted through fear, but with an unfettered imagination, fueled by a questing intellect and a joyful awe at the unending wonder of it all. And so here is the tool, a mental device to apply whenever you find yourself with the luxury of time to contemplate the true meaning of something. Instead of reflexively applying well-worn, perhaps even deliberately programmed patterns of response, take a moment to consider the possibility that there are possibilities. You can apply the idea to whatever extent it is useful, a sliding scale of potentiality drawing on whatever knowledge you have acquired to the extent you have time to devote. For example, I find reincarnation very useful. If I encounter somebody whose behavior strikes me as odd or notable, I first look at them to see if perhaps they have been significantly affected by one particular incarnation as an animal. It is amazing how much easier it is to accept someone's mannerisms when you can see them clearly expressing their inner stork, or turtle, or baboon. And in the end, if presenting this exploration in thought results in nothing more than one person being momentarily less judgmental towards one other, it will have been a success. But the fact is, things are going to happen. Say, for example, the public disclosure of the truth behind the UFO phenomenon. If hearing these sounds allows one person to seriously contemplate alternatives to the official story, it will have been a success. If it allows one person to start on a path that ultimately reconnects them or their child to their inner truth, it will have been beyond belief.